today, Pete Warnick, Dr. Banjo, is going to call in and talk about all the stuff that he's been doing. You know, Pete's one of those guys that keeps bluegrass alive. I think he should be the permanent international universal, even for contact with aliens, ambassador of bluegrass. Plays it, writes about it, knows about it, talks about it. He's going to call in, talk about all the good stuff that he's been doing, and I like the guy. I'm going to take advantage of you so that I have a chance to talk to Pete. I haven't talked to him in a couple years.
Tell the people who you are.
Pete Warnick all day, every day.
Pete, I'm going to
call where I live.
Where you live.
I'm so happy that you called in. I was telling them as we started out that I'm kind of using their time to talk with you because I haven't had a chance to chat with you for a while. So
yeah, likewise.
And they're welcome to join in and listen as we catch up on things.
And as you came on the line, we were playing Frank's Blues, and I want you to explain a little bit about that because that's one of those weird old great traditional bluegrass tunes with a phase shifter in it on the banjo.
Well, there's a few odd things in that. It has more chords in it than usual. Usually we use what are called the 1-4-5 chords, like G, C, and D. But this one has a 5 minor, it has a flatted 3, and then it has a series of diminished chords in it. And also it has a 2 minor chord in it. So it's sort of what some people might call a little bit on the newgrass side of things, but I don't know, I've treaded a path back and forth between the traditional bluegrass that I really love and then more experimental stuff that I sort of can't help but get interested in if I like the way it sounds. So the story behind that tune is Hot Rise Bus was on its way down to Texas from Denver sometime in the middle 80s, I guess. And Frank Edmondson, who is our trusty bus driver, road manager, sound man, and who worked for us for 9 years, he was driving the bus, and I was just up in the front kind of keeping him company and messing around, and this banjo tune started emerging, and I said, I don't know what to do with this. You know, I just got this first part. He says, go to A minor. Which is weird in the key of D. If you're a musician, most people wouldn't think of going to A minor in the key of D. It's the A major would be one of the more typical chords, but it gives you a slightly different flavor. And he says, go to A minor 3 times. So I did that, and I took a few other suggestions, including he said, do something really wacky at the very end. So I tried to put in this diminished thing, and you almost never hear diminished chords in bluegrass at all. I think Don Reno might have used them here and there, and once in a while, somebody does something diminished by accident, almost. Some of Tony Rice's favorite licks use sort of notes out of diminished chords. So I'm not trying to talk over the heads of the listeners who don't play, but those who do play might get a little idea about how... So it's sort of how my style has developed, because I'm hugely, mainly influenced by Earl Scruggs. He's the guy that just laid it all out so well that a lot of people spend almost all their time copying him, and I love to copy him, but I don't think it's a good career move to just be known as a good copier, even if I could really copy it that well. So you have to forge your own path, and so by having a little extra musical knowledge that came from various friends who were in music schools, I never attended any music classes myself, but I would jam with people who say, oh, that's the 5 minor chord, or that's the 2 major or something, and I eventually got familiar with that lingo and then, you know, realized that the Beatles were, and the Beach Boys and people like that were doing pretty amazing things with that kind of stuff, so a little teaspoon of it once in a while into bluegrass seems to help.
Well, Pete, you've been at that level, and you're called Dr. Banjo for a number of reasons. I think not the least of which is you have a couple of doctor's degrees, but we won't bore everybody with
just
that.
Just one, actually. Just one. Okay. One was enough.
I'll give you an honorary one, then. How's that?
Oh, I'll take it.
But you've always sort of been, I mean, you've done radio shows. I remember up in New York, weren't you kind of doing this end of the deal for
a while? Yeah, I keep coming back to this. You know, I went to Columbia in New York City, and known as a very fine institution of higher learning, and, you know, I don't mean to sound like I'm just trashing them, but a lot of my time in the classroom was wasted. I don't really feel like their teaching and learning style meant a whole lot to me, and it went, I mean, I survived. I got grades on the tests that were okay, but then I found that I didn't remember anything, and And in many cases, I just never, ever used the stuff I got in college. But the one thing that I got at Columbia, which is paying me back over and over, is that I got to work on the college radio station. So from the age of 17 on, I had a bluegrass show, and it was the only bluegrass being played in New York City on the radio, if you can imagine that. It was not only the only bluegrass program, but there was nobody even playing bluegrass on any other show. So the listeners from around a metropolitan area of 16 million people, a lot of them knew, I mean a small percentage, but still adds up to a lot of people, knew that I was on Saturday mornings for, at first it was an hour, and went to 2 hours. And I had that show for 7 years, from 63 to 1970, and wow. I got to really further my bluegrass education, first through acquiring about every imprint album that was available in the 1960s, which is basically all the, you know, the Bible of recorded bluegrass, the Flat and Scruggs and Monroe and Jim and Jesse and Osborne Brothers, Stanley Brothers. I still have a lot of those records, and then I also got to interview, much as you're doing.
There you go.
People, except you and I know each other, but yes. I mean, I could go up to Jimmy Martin and say, "Look, I have a bluegrass radio show in New York. Can I do an interview?" And he would be glad to do station IDs for me. I got a copy of the 1964 record Guitar Pick'em President with a special promotional card and a note from Jimmy, and got to interview Don Reno, and you know, I did a full hour-long show with Monroe.
Wow.
And the Bluegrass Boys in 1966, and David Grishman is still seeing about trying to turn that whole hour show into a full record, because it's quite interesting. And there is a record out on David's label of David playing with Red Allen and the Kentuckians on my radio show.
Really?
In 1966. So this is stuff that's treasured memories for me now, and I'm sitting on quite an archive of interviews that go back 40 years and more. So,
oh, wow.
I got station IDs from the Stanley Brothers, both Carter and Ralph. Can you believe it? Because
no.
I only got to see Carter one time, but I did interview him. So this is stuff that just means the world to me.
Well,
and I feel so lucky as a New Yorker to have gotten this type of immersion, which wouldn't have been available except for, you know, the radio show that I got to do.
Well, and you know, Pete, you've always been one of those people that not only did you play it and live it, but you chronicled it as you went. And I think you recognized, as we're talking here, the importance of making notes, and not just to educate yourself, but, you know, before I clicked you on the air, I brought up out of the, you know, the room that I practice in, my Masters of the Five-String Banjo. You were putting things that like that together, and that's done with Tony Trischka. You were always writing the books, and as I tell people, in my dark ages of bluegrass, which was probably the 70s when I was going to school and trying to make something, I wanted, you were a touchstone for me. The only way I can put this, I could always come back and find a book or find one of your records. I still have that Music Minus One, where you have that play that funky bluegrass white boy haircut on there.
On the cover,
Afro.
I try to see how long I can get my hair to stick out in all directions.
Right. That's right.
And my before the photo session, my wife said it would look better if I just sort of combed it out for maximum effect. And that picture always gets a reaction when they see that.
Oh, yeah, that's
great. Hardly any hair.
That's great. It's great. But it's all those things were always interwoven, and you were always there, and you were always writing, teaching, instructing, talking, playing.
Thank you, Steve. That's very nice to hear.
Well, and it is. It was so much that you recognized
for your own benefit and everyone else that you needed to you know, make some note of what was happening, because I think you knew, and correct me, Pete, and I don't need to speak for you, but you knew you were at the beginning of the middle, maybe, of what was a brand-new experience in music in America. The bluegrass was,
you know, I didn't have a general overall perspective on it, although now when I look back and I see myself where I am at the first Bluegrass Festival,
yeah.
I have one photograph of myself standing by the stage in 1965 as I was recording a lot of the very first Bluegrass Festival in Fincastle. And at the time, I just thought, oh, man, it's so terrible that I was born so late. I missed out on you know, following bluegrass in the 50s, and they're all talking about, when Benny Martin and Reno played with
Monroe, and oh, that was like when I was 3 years old, and I was mad that I wasn't, you know, there at the beginning. But now I look at it and I say, boy, you know, I'm 66 now, and easily three quarters of my life has been really with bluegrass as a primary focus. So, and then collecting a lot of records as a DJ and being a subscriber to Bluegrass Unlimited from the second issue.
Yeah.
And you name it, all these different things, they all roll together in this immersion that I treasure. In fact, it looked so attractive to me that when I first started having success in the bluegrass field and making enough money from my first instruction book to live on, I really started doing something that I'd never imagined doing, which is imagining leaving all this academic training. And I was already gainfully employed at Cornell as a sociologist, but I had this other stuff going on the side, and I thought, man, I could actually leave academia and find out if there's a place for me in the world of bluegrass. And I had been smart in research that I would have found out certainly not, because almost nobody was making their living at bluegrass music at the time. Almost nobody. Even the people in, you know, the sidemen and famous bands often had other income sources, and there just weren't that many bands doing that well back in the 60s or the 70s. But
you made your leap, though.
Love conquers all in some ways, anyway. It doesn't conquer everything, but I came to the philosophy, which I've seen written subsequently many places, which is you do what you love. And John Hartford used to mentor me a lot, and that was one of the things he says, do what you love, and that way, even if it doesn't work out commercially, you haven't wasted your time.
That's a good idea.
And then a lot of the, you know, self-help gurus say, do what you love, because then you'll get so good at it, you'll probably be able to make some money at it. You know, you don't know how now, but just if you love it, just do it. And I couldn't help myself back then. I was in school and struggling mightily to, you know, make decent grades, but there weren't enough hours in the day because I was always a pretty slow reader. And I remember the worst argument I ever had with my mother was she said, you know, that bluegrass show you're doing is just taking too much time. And I said, Mom, it's only an hour or two, and, you know, come on, you know. But little did either of us know that what I was really doing was preparing for the rest of my life, the career that I've had, and all that.
Well, clearly,
loving research that I did turns up in all kinds of places, mm-hmm. whether it's in records that I recommend to my students, you know, because I'm very familiar with them, or I was just down at IBMA, and Dave Peterson and I got in a jam session. He's kind of famous for knowing like every song in the world. But I helped him on quite a few of the lyrics of some of the songs because they stick in my head, and I just love that music so much. I love the community, too.
Pete, you mentioned lyrics. You have that book, the Bluegrass Songbook, right?
Yes.
Yeah, I mean, it's just like you're always churning out new things that people can get their hands on. If they can't hear it all, they can read it, they can see it, they can catch up. It makes a nice library and a nice resource to go back and connect the dots, and you just seem to be one of those dots that pulls the rest of them together.
I'll tell you what, it's, you know what, Steve, is when I started in New York City, that, you know, trying to play bluegrass, it was like, you're trying to play what? you know, and to be quite truthful about it, back in the early 60s, the white Southern people were not smiled on too much by the rest of society because they were, you know, the Jim Crow was still in effect, and they were fighting pretty hard to keep it. And so I was very ambivalent myself, going south. I didn't know what to make of it, and I found it was great to be there in person because I could see that there was a more complex culture than the stereotypes. And there was this amazing friendliness and warmth and, just neighborliness that I did not experience in New York. And I started realizing that just because somebody has flaws doesn't mean they're bad. And just because you don't have that flaw doesn't mean you don't have some other flaw that's maybe even a little worse, you know. So it sort of opened me up to it was the first time I really traveled out of the New York and Northeast area when I started going south to go hear bluegrass. I'd only been out west once with my family, and then the rest of the time I was kind of a New Yorker and a kind of a highly educated segment of that society too. So I was not really a typical bluegrass person, but I just felt this magnetism of the spirit of bluegrass just every which way when I talked to the people, like when I got to talk to the Stanley Brothers or Lester Flatt or Monroe, even, you know, who is sort of scary. But when I talked to them, it kept drawing me in more and more, and the lyrics of the songs meant more and more to me, and then the musicianship of people like Scruggs or Monroe or just so many of the greats, you know, just kept speaking to me. And so I wanted to learn this, and I had no help. There was no help available except the record.
There were no Pete Warnings writing books for you.
No, there was not. I don't know how much time you have for yakety yak.
Go ahead. No, go ahead. You're fine.
One funny story that I like to tell is, Platt and Scruggs used to come to New York regularly. So even when I'd only been playing the banjo for 2 months and I was not quite 15, here they come up. This is before the Carnegie Hall concert, which I also went to later, but this was in 1961 with the opening act, the 19-year-old Joan Baez.
Mm.
And so they're selling a songbook, and Lester says, hey, at the back of the songbook, here's, Earl describes his banjo style. And I go, oh, this is too great. Finally, because all I had was the Pete Seeger book, and Pete Seeger says, you got to listen to this guy Scruggs. But he had no idea what Scruggs is doing. So I said, oh, great. So I look at the songbook, and it only has one page for the banjo thing, and it's mostly all of its chord diagrams, which is like, okay, here's the alphabet. We already knew that, so let's get to the right hand. What's the right hand doing? And this is paraphrasing it, but it's only a couple of sentences. It says, basically, you go thumb, index, middle, and things will occur to you. That's what he says. Things will occur to you.
That's kind of a Zen approach.
Oh, well, that's good, but what about what you're doing? I want to know what you're doing. And I later found out, because I got to know Earl pretty well, and he basically had no idea what he was doing. He couldn't describe it to anybody. He felt awkward about that, and because everybody wanted to know, but he could never play the same thing twice in a row the same way, which is not the way a lot of people think music is played, because classical music, you can't do that. But, you know, when it's more like conversation, you know, you might say, tell a story, but it won't come out the same way every time you tell it, down to the, you know, each word. And that's the way Earl had trained his fingers to operate. And I started having to teach banjo when I was 18, because people started asking me once I had figured it out, come slow, painstaking trial and error, listening to records and imitating. Now I could, by the time I was 18, I could play decently, and had people say, well, can you give me a lesson? So I would write down every note I could play, and it took me forever because I would change it every time I slowed it down. And it was very, it took a while, not just to learn how to play, but then to learn how to teach the stuff. And I had private students there in Ithaca, and you know, for my own gain, you know, I had a skill that I could share and make some money on the side. And then I realized more and more, somebody gave me the idea to write an instruction book, and I thought, wow, I could do for a lot of people what I wish had been done for me.
Right.
And that's been my mantra. You know, the songbook was the same way. I thought, wow, I know these songs, and what's the easiest way to show these songs? And rather than using music notation, I use a simplified tablature to make sure bluegrass people could understand the melodies. And then I thought, well, what's important in, you know, when you have a songbook? And I thought, well, how do you sing bluegrass? And there still is no instruction book on how bluegrass is sung. And the closest thing to it is that book I wrote in the mid-70s called The Bluegrass Songbook.
Right.
Jim and Jesse on the cover,
that's
red
right.
cover.
Yeah.
And there's all these quotes that I pulled out of interviews that I did, and I got some really great interviews with, you know, people like Pete Rowan, who really could explain some stuff that Monroe wasn't able to explain about Monroe, and just interviewed all these people, Ralph Stanley, Jim and Jesse, and the best they were able to describe it, it still leaves a lot of mystery, but when Charlie Waller said, "Don't hold back. When you're yelling at your kids, you don't hold back." Now, that's advice anybody can relate to.
You know, I think Pavarotti actually said that too once.
Yeah. Well, anybody with kids can relate to that. You know, basically, you know, they gave me these keys, and it was still in code, you might say. A lot of times when you ask a bluegrass person why they came up with certain lick or certain way of doing something, they just say, "Well, that's the way I hear it." And that just means, to me, it means in their imagination they can imagine something the way you can visualize a scene in your mind. They can imagine, you know, an auditory experience, and then they can copy that right out of their imagination onto their instrument or onto their voice. And then they always talked about how you have to put feeling into it. And I never really understood that at first. And then as I grew older, I got more into just using dynamics and getting quieter and louder can help you realize that you can express something just like in speech, you know, just by the way you change your cadence. You can draw people in, and there's a real art to it that people learn by osmosis in bluegrass, and in classical music they learn it at conservatories where it's just taught and you get tested on it. But in the bluegrass way, you know, you join the Osborne Brothers band as a bass player, and then you get to be around Bobby and Sonny enough, and it rubs off, and then you can start your own band with their blessing, and that's the way it's done in the world of bluegrass. It's very old world. It's very, you know, it's more cultural and less technical.
It's almost, it's kind of an oral, but it's also an aural tradition where you have to hear it and see it. Yeah.
Yeah, well, I mean, if you, the oral, O-R-A-L, you might sit around with some of these guys and listen to their stories.
Right.
And I've heard some real good ones over the years where the point of the story was something needed to be done musically a certain way, and somebody wasn't getting it, and then somebody said something, and then they got, from there on, it worked. So those stories sometimes have a good point to them, but then sometimes, like Monroe, if he was going to teach somebody, he would just keep saying, "No, that ain't right," and then play it to them again, and then when he got it, he would act satisfied. And again, it's not the standard techniques of teaching, but and when I teach, I actually try to use both, because I think if you can analyze the, you know, what is going on when you get a G chord, you have three notes ringing in harmony, and it turns out they're the first and third and fifth note of a scale. So you don't have to learn scales to be able to play chords, but when you play a chord, that's what's going on. And if you know that, and then you say, well, you can add the sixth note of the scale to get a sweet sound, and if you want a kind of a harsher sound that fits the blues, then you go for the flatted third or the flatted seventh note of the scale. A few tricks like this that when you show them to novices, they go, oh, and then they want to be left alone so they can discover all that stuff as literally thousands and thousands of people have done before them, and the tools that will turn them into a musician. It's not like if you buy enough baseball cards, you finally qualify as a musician. You simply have to have your hands on the instrument, and hopefully with other people in a team effort to make it bluegrass, you know. So that's what I've been doing lately a lot. I've been teaching a lot of novices how to jam.
Well, and you have band camps. You have jam camps out there. And
right.
I know the way that you are because
I've seen you do this before in several settings. You're very inclusive. It's bring everybody in, and whatever skill level, let's figure out what we're doing, and we can all enjoy this and learn from it, I think is what you do things.
Yeah, well, you can take a two-chord song, and some jazz person will say, well, that is too easy. I'm too good for that. Well, Ralph Stanley, when he sings Little Bird, he just has two chords, and nobody can tell me that's not great music. Just because it's simple doesn't mean it's not great. But if it's simple, then also Grandma with her auto harp can play along.
That's right.
And it's like, hello, you mean the top guy in the field can play, you know, you can join right in? Yes, you can, you know. Sometimes it's very important to slow the tempos down a lot, but this the simple chord structures of bluegrass make it very possible for a brand new person to play along with an experienced person and make a nice contribution, so grandpa, who really knows his instrument, can give a mandolin to the 8-year-old grandson, and then once the grandson learns how to hit a few chords, they can sing a song together. And that's magic. That's something that you don't get. You know, you can't do tennis that way. You know, you can't do baseball that way when somebody's going to drop the ball a lot. But if somebody will just change chords from G to C and D at the right times, then you can play some great songs and have a great time with them. And I just eat that up.
I know that you do, and that's what you strive for. And and you get people together of all talents, and that's what I've seen you do it.
And you do it very well. You have an, I didn't want you to call in just so I could give you a comment, but you have a very engaging.
Oh, keep it up.
I didn't think you'd tell me to stop. You have a very good way of bringing people into the game, so to speak, since you're talking about baseball, bringing them into the game and keeping them interested. And it's a very positive influence that you have.
Yeah, well, I'll tell you, this is no joke. And now that I'm sort of a missionary now for bluegrass jamming. I mean, I now have this thing called the Wernick Method, and I've certified about 50 teachers now. We're in like 35 states and a few foreign countries, and it's growing quite a lot. And it's only the second year I've been doing it. And so a lot of times when I talk about it, like, you know, here I am, you know, talking on the radio and. Or whatever it is we're on.
we're on a radio. It's internet. We're in Japan. We're in the Netherlands. Yeah, we're everywhere.
Right. We're just like everywhere. There's probably people with their ears pressed to the radio.
Oh, yeah. Oh, no doubt. No doubt.
Checking us out. But anyway, so I say, well, look, you know, say you're the parent of an 8 or 9-year-old kid and you want them to, you know, go up with some good social skills. Well, you can get them in sports, which is great. You can get them in high school band or, you know, whatever, you know, school band. They can get into, you know, all sorts of hobbies, you know, whatever, whether it's, you know, fast cars or card games or whatever, you know, video games. But think about what bluegrass does for the soul, especially. It's a lifelong thing. You can start it when you're 88. You can start it when you're 8 and still be doing it when you're 98. You really can if you live that long. Mm. And it's not something you have to put down once you graduate, because how can you get a football team together, you know, when you're not in a school setting, you know, and there's no injuries. You know, rarely does somebody injure themselves playing music. It's a team situation. Nobody has to be on the bench. Nobody, in bluegrass, you know, in sports, half the people who come lose. They lose, and it's hard to lose. In bluegrass, everybody comes, and everybody wins, because if they like bluegrass, and if you get shouldered out of a jam session because you're the third banjo and they don't really want a third banjo, you can find a guitar player who's not playing and say, let's go in another room or walk under another tree here at the festival, and you can start another jam. But you can't start another baseball game suddenly with the people who are sitting on the bench. So I'm not putting down sports, but sports has some disadvantages to it, some disappointments and some hard times that, and expense, too, in many cases, that bluegrass, you got to buy an instrument.
Correct.
And you have to buy all my DVDs.
You do have to buy all your DVDs.
So, but anyway, you see what I'm getting at.
Oh, sure.
Fantastic. And you learn teamwork. That's the important thing. I think sports is great because you have to learn how to lose. You have to learn teamwork. You have to learn when it's somebody else's turn to be the star, and your job is just to help them do their job better and encourage them. And that happens in sports, but it also happens, like, a lot in music, where if you can't be a team player, no matter how good of a virtuoso you are, you don't belong in a bluegrass band. Maybe you're going to be a guitar on classical guitar or something you can do all by yourself. But bluegrass is something you have to do with other people for it to really be bluegrass. And once you come out of the closet and, you know, having learned a few basics and find a nice environment to play with, which might only be one other person who also knows a few chords, and then you got a songbook, and there you go. You can spend hours with that person having fun with the songs. So to me, this is not merely a nice hobby. It's truly a palliative and a great resource for human development and for a good society. I mean, I think that in the days before recordings, like around the turn of the century, early 1900s, it was very common for people to sing on buses, and when they went over to each other's house, almost everybody had a piano, and then if a hit song came out, like Alexander's Ragtime Band, everybody brought the sheet music, and then they could sing Alexander's Ragtime Band in their own living room, and there was a lot of participation, and grandma could sing, and the five-year-old could sing, and they'd have a fun time. And then along came recordings, and it was all delegated out to professionals, and then you would maybe dance to that stuff, but not people learning music went into decline at that point. It never died, obviously.
Well, that's a good point. That's a good point you make.
Yeah, but I mean, in 1920, there were a lot of mandolin orchestras, banjo orchestras, and of course, all this singing on buses and in living rooms. And I think, why not bring that back? Come on, you know, just because we have video games and digital stuff that's mind-boggling, it does not change the reality that making music with your own hands and a nice instrument with a friend or a relative or a few.
It's a blast.
And recreate the great music that, you know, Carter Stanley or somebody wrote. Man, what a rich thing we get to tap into, and it doesn't cost any money to jam. You just start.
You just start.
So, you know, once you get your capo and your strings and your guitar, you know, that's it.
I don't think, Pete, I don't think it could be said any better than that. What you've just explained about what the whole bluegrass experience is, I mean, to me, that sums up your approach to it, and I think I knew you would be the person that could explain it. But there are people in the chat room saying, wow, this guy's really, like, yeah, well, that's Dr. Banjo. He's got the whole outlook on it at this point, I
think.
Well,
I've had some experience at it, I'm pleased to say, because when I, besides just doing the teaching I've been doing, you know, I've been teaching classes since 1980, I think I'm the first person to do a week-long bluegrass instructional week. And then a few years later, I got voted in as the president of IBMA, and that part of that job meant giving, you know, speeches and talks. And also, I was at the board table when we voted in the first time IBMA had enough money to spend on a project besides keeping ourselves alive. We actually spent $20,000 on public relations firm, same one that did it for Martha White. And so they came back with just three words, and some of you might think, oh, they ripped us off, but those three words were so powerful. And those, you want to hear what the three words are?
Absolutely.
Well, one's perspicacity. No. If they're going to be that expensive, they should have a lot of syllables. But no, one is just alternative, one is community, and the other one is nature. And if you think hard enough, you can use the CAN, community, alternative, nature, as a little acronym, and remember those words and let them sit for a while. It's not 100% obvious when you first hear about it, but they studied why people love bluegrass. And then they say, well, bluegrass isn't for everybody, but for people who resonate with the words nature, community, and alternative, they're probably going to be people who would like bluegrass if they heard it.
Yeah.
In other words, somebody who's not just following the crowd, who doesn't mind going off in a, you know, off the main path and get into something that, you know, might be an acquired taste for some, but there's something special about it. They're marching to a different drummer. And people who are proud to do that are likely to be bluegrassy in nature. You know, Monroe is certainly like that. I was certainly like that in New York City, saying, no, I'm going to learn bluegrass banjo. You're going to what? You know, I say, well, I'm doing it. If you don't like it, check me out in a few years. I might be pretty good by then.
But before we went on the air, you told me where you're setting. I told everyone as I go on that I'm sitting in Kentucky, and it's a nice day. And then you came in and told me where. Tell the people where you're sitting right now.
Well, I live in Niwot, Colorado, which is about 10 miles out of Boulder. And I live in the plains, not in the mountains. But you can sure see the mountains from my house. And It's just a beautiful place, and I live on 2 acres and beautiful trees that are changing colors now, and the sky is gray, but I have an amazing bunch of colors to look out my window and see, and I've lived in this house 36 years.
Wow.
With my wife that I've been with for 43 years.
That would be Nurse Banjo.
That would be Nurse Banjo, Joan Wernick, also known as Non-D Leonard on the early records.
That's right.
And we are very, very, very fortunate people, and I love the idea that my life now consists of a lot of giving back, and it's not all charity, obviously, because I make a living at it, but I just love that I'm connected to this worldwide community. We're going to be going to Prague, and I'll be doing a jam camp in Prague with a whole bunch of European students, as well as I hope some European teachers who I will then certify to be jam teachers, Wernick Method style.
Wow.
So I've got this large reach that I'm capable of making, and I could go on about how, you know, I'm still in touch with the people who I learned to play music with back in the Bronx in the early 60s. I was just together with them because we do these reunions every year. So I'm in touch with my oldest buddies, and the music start that I got from them is what got me into this whole mess in the first place. So I don't know. I feel very fulfilled about it, and you and I would not have met were it not for bluegrass, and we always have something to talk about. How are you doing with your banjo? How am I doing with my banjo?
Mm-hmm.
How? Who did you see lately, and whether it was or how they're looking, how their health is holding up or whatever. Because there's a great community of people, and that's the thing that in that CAN acronym, alternative, you heard nature, I think it's kind of self-evident, community for people who follow bluegrass like those listening now. You know what I'm talking about, the relationships you have with people, even people from other countries sometimes. If you know somebody loves bluegrass, you know you have an important thing in common, and you probably would love to hang out at their house for a while, if they wanted to go on a hike, you'd probably want to go with them because they're nice people.
Yeah.
And they wouldn't hurt you.
That's right.
Probably.
That's always my thought when I'm taking a walk.
Stay away from... Ladies, stay away from guys named Willie.
Hey, listen.
I married a guy named Willie, but it worked out okay, but that was an exception.
When we started off the program and I told people you'd be joining us, I played Frank's Blues, which you talked about. I like to start out with Radio Boogie because I think your explanation is that from your experience on college radio, when you went to different areas, you were spinning around the dial looking for someone playing music like Pete Wernick did back in New York.
Well, there wasn't much that I could hear on the radio. I actually did have a little crystal radio my dad set up for me, and I could get very far away stations, and I'd go to sleep with this little speaker on my pillow, and I could hear WWVA, and once in a while hear the Osmond Brothers or Jimmy Martin, or some station in New Jersey that was playing, must have been the Louvin Brothers, because I had that sound in my head, and I didn't know who it was, just would hear it. And so... there's some magic to be found sometimes through the airwaves. Spinning the radio dial, though, in New York would mostly just get you a lot of top 40 back in the old... I remember when the first country station came into New York City, and they had to call it Countrypolitan because they were afraid the sophisticated New York types wouldn't accept country music, so they changed it for us, and I wish they hadn't.
Hey, the second tune I played is a tune that I think is, well, I know it's near and dear to your heart, Ruthie.
Yeah, that's my parents. That's
oh,
a
I know.
Story as plain as can be. Wrote it right after my mother had passed, and I'd been spending a lot of time with my dad, and the key line in there is, walk through the streets singing Ruthie, and that was actually taken off something my dad said, so... for anybody who likes that song, you might like to know my dad was a math teacher, and he was a very, very hard-working guy, and he was quite reserved in general. He had a good sense of humor, and he played the harmonica, and even had bought a banjo, which is why there was one in the house when I wanted to start. But he was very reserved, and my mother had had a stroke, and of course that's devastating. And so we were sitting in a waiting room while my mother's being evaluated, and he's just sitting there next to me, and he says, "I'm just sitting here so quietly," he says, "but I feel like going, running out in the street and yelling, 'Ruthie's sick, Ruthie's sick.'"
Oh.
And this is something so uncharacteristic for him to say, it just stuck with me. And so that's where the line, you know, wanna, at first he, when he just meets her, which was my imagination, but, you know, walk through the streets singing Ruthie, you know, and then at the end he's walking through the streets without Ruthie. Mm. And boy, that, you know.
Beautiful. Beautiful lyric, Pete.
Well, it covers from like about 1930 to about 1992. And whenever you can get that much passage of time into a song with the same people in it, you probably got something good. Uh-huh. And all I had to do, once I had made up the melody, which just kind of came to me in my dad's living room, I was taking a shower later, and by the time I got out of the shower, I had the whole song in my head. I just wrote it down. Because it was just what their life had been like. And I knew that stuff, you know. So I was lucky to have that, the muse hit me right when it did. And then the song was successful. And a lot of people do come up to me and talk about that song. And, you know,
it's beautiful.
A few others that I've written because it touched them. And
yeah.
Boy, when you can touch somebody that way, it makes you feel very special.
Yeah. Gosh, Pete, I've enjoyed this so much. I'm reluctant to let you go. I know that you don't want to spend your whole day doing this, but I want you to tell. We've talked a little bit about your jam camps. Tell the people listening how they can find out more about Dr. Banjo on the.
Well, I got about the shortest website URL possible: DGJam, 5 letters.
Okay.
DGJam.com, and if you just go there, it'll all. Just present itself right to you. We have a good website with tons of banjo stuff on it.
That surprises me.
The page that you go to, we call the Jamalot page, and from there you see the list of two-chord songs. We have photos, not just diagrams, but photos of hands-on guitars making the basic chords so that you can learn how to read chords. And then, of course, you can, you know, use the website to acquire jam-along videos that are at very slow speeds with the chords shown right on the screen. And all kind of, you know, how to find people to jam, there's an article about that. And then there's a kind of pedagogy article or two where why I teach this way and why I don't teach by simply handing somebody a piece of tablature and say, work on this and I'll see you next week. It's just not the way to learn bluegrass. And so I have the best that I've been able to express myself on these topics, and most of it's just free. And we are needing teachers, so if there's somebody listening who thinks this might be a good thing for them to teach, we would encourage you to just click the teachers button and then see what it takes to become a Wernick certified teacher, which is mostly the desire to do it and some know-how about teaching in general and know-how about bluegrass in general. It doesn't take, you know, you don't have to be a star or performer or anything, just know how to play.
Oops. Pete? I think we lost him. I can get him back. Hold on. We can do this. A quarter ran out. Talk amongst yourself there in the chat room while I find Pete again. Technical difficulties. Pete, are you there?
Yes.
All right. I lost you for a second.
Yeah, 2 steps. Power outage out here in beautiful Colorado.
I just thought my quarter ran out.
Well, anyway, so basically go to bgjam.com and, you know, there's video clips. There's just so much stuff. Most of the whole website is free all over the place, and 180 questions and answers in the Ask Dr. Banjo section, my life in photographs, quite a few audio clips and video clips too. You know, see Pete playing with Doc Watson, see Pete playing with Earl Scruggs, see Pete in Russia with Joan. You know, we got it all there. You can spend after the Steve's program, of course.
You know, you can do it now. That's
really
okay.
hate to get up out of your internet chair. Just spend another hour on my website.
You even wrote the protocol of jamming. Is that a fair? Weren't you?
Yeah. You know, a lot of people say, well, this is the you have to learn the unspoken, unwritten rules. And I say, never mind this unspoken, unwritten thing. People need to learn these rules.
So yeah.
I sat down and I wrote down what I understand to be the international, worldwide rules of bluegrass jamming, mostly based on common sense. But when I jammed in Russia, I couldn't have a conversation with those people, but we jammed for 2 hours right in front of a bunch of befuddled onlookers on a train in Russia that couldn't understand how people could, who didn't share a language and weren't looking at paper, how could they play music together? That's that miracle again, you know. I mean, those are some of the things that can happen.
Well, listen, I really appreciate you calling in. I've enjoyed this immensely. I'm going to have to catch up. I couldn't make it to IBMA this year. Now, next year will be a little bit further jaunt for me down the road.
Well, the other Steve made it. The other Steve Martin made it.
Well, so. And I didn't want to mix. I'm always afraid of that matter, you know, that matter-antimatter thing that we used to watch on Star Trek. I don't want
you're
to
the
be
the alternate
same.
Universe.
Yes, I'm afraid we'll explode. then how do I explain that to everybody? So, and I know
you
that you
write a song about it.
Yeah, what...
Because then people will repeat it so often that eventually they'll understand.
Hey, Pete, thanks so much. Thanks for calling in, man. Now, in about an hour or so, Sonny Osborne will rise up
yeah,
to the occasion and call
you.
In. And we just, we have jumping off points with Sonny, and then it goes where it goes.
Oh, I know that.
You know,
he's one of the most interesting people I've ever met in my life. And I, only a few more people that I ever met in academia would be as interesting as Sonny Osborne, which is as much as anything the reason why I chose the bluegrass world over academia. He's a savant, really.
Yes.
And he doesn't have sometimes the vocabulary to say certain things, but he makes sure you get it. And he has passion. Right in his older years, he still has this incredible passion that has sustained him through a pretty challenging life.
Yes.
You know, and the fact that he's gotten through it and he still has good humor and he's got some lessons to share, so you're very lucky that you get a chance to give him a platform and interact. I'm happy for you.
You know, he really enjoys it. Now, the first time I had him on, I actually sent you an email and I said, hey, what do you think would be some good things? And we used some of those topics. The next morning, he texted me on the Sunday after the first show and said, was that okay? I want to do it every Saturday now. And I said, Sonny, if you want to, I'll do it whenever you want to. But he enjoys it. He enjoys the discussion. He enjoys the fact that he talks about these things that he's lived through and
That's more important to him than most people would realize, because he wasn't an educated person, as I'm sure he's explained. You know, he was out of school by the time he was 14 or 15, and then he was thrown into the world of adult musicians, and that became his world, and
right.
That's what he became an expert in, and it taught him a lot.
Oh,
and
yeah.
Now, and he's verbal. He likes to, he likes to expound, and he has plenty on his mind, so... it's a great thing that he's like that, because almost nobody from that era in bluegrass, besides even not being possibly alive, very few people will actually get there and just start telling you like it was and telling you what he really thinks. And he doesn't mind being blunt. need I explain?
Well, our rule is...
There's too many people mincing words, and then you get this sort of chopped up... mash that's not as good as a real steak dinner. When you finish conversation with Sonny, you really feel like you've had a hearty meal.
Yes, you're fully engaged. You're fully engaged with a very vibrant mentality. I mean, like you said, he maybe wasn't school learning, but geez, what a brilliant guy. And he always says, if you ask me, I'll answer it. And I always say, look, I don't have a delete button, so we're both going to have to work on that.
Right. Well, because he's now, I think he needs it even, once in a while he used to come sit at a table, and that's how I got to know him. He would just be sitting there, and you could ask him anything, you'd talk about anything, and you could have a good chat with him. Sometimes, even when I was quite young, I used to do that, and he was a willing participant. Sometimes he was so grouchy, I stayed away from him, but other times he was just a sweetheart. And, you know, like anybody might be, especially you find out why he was grouchy, because, you know, there's a lot of rough things you have to put up with in business. And but now he's out of the loop. He doesn't get to go down to the Opry and hang out with his friends there, and he doesn't get to go, you know, to the Festival of the Bluegrass or, you know, to the Birchmere or all these places where he has good friends. So he's home there, and he gets on the radio, and it kind of wakes up that whole part of his life, and he's far from done mentally. He's done as a banjo player right now.
Right.
But
it's always working. His mind is always working.
He'll never run out of topics. You know, just ask him about any song he's recorded and how they found it and how he decided to play the way he did on the song rather than play some other way. He would, you know, he can express what a lot of the other great musicians sometimes can't express very well.
He can do that, and he can tell you that it was in 1953 at a quarter after four and what building they were in. You know, that, and that's all real.
Like that. Well, that's still remarkable. You know, you just say, wow, you know, think about it, Steve. I mean, it's one of the miracles that I, you know, feel grateful for every day. You know, we have this thing on top of our neck. It's about the size of a bowling ball or smaller, and it probably weighs less, and it would put every computer in the world to shame what it can remember and the nuance that it can give in speaking and the vocabulary, and it's capable of learning all these languages and, you know, learning the language of music, and it drives Sonny Osborne's fingers, that thing on top of, you know, how does it do that? How does sound come into those things on the side of your head called the ears, and then the thing at the bottom of your head called your throat can make a sound that harmonizes with the thing that went into your ears? How does that work? You know, it's miraculous to me, and it's something to be not just take for granted. And when I think of Sonny, I think of, like, how does he remember all that stuff? How does he know how to, if I ask him to, you know, to play any of those songs, he could play them, you know?
Yep.
So, you know, he's a treasure. And well, he's got to be into his 70s by now, right?
Yes. Yeah, he's 2 months younger than J.D., as he brags about all the time.
Yeah, so, all right, so they're both, I think, 75. So,
right.
You know, great time to learn what can be learned from our distinguished elders in our tribe. And he sure won. So would you give him my best? I haven't talked to him lately. And,
I'll tell him.
I'm very fond of him, and he's sometimes fond of me. So, would you just tell him Pete thinks about him often? And
I will.
Really treasures the times I've had with him and his music over the years.
And Pete, I will pass that back to you from me, that I treasure the time and the music that you've shared with me. And gosh, I'm so, and please don't be a stranger. I run this pretty informally. So far, no one's told me what I can do and what I can't do. So anytime you want to call. Please let me know, and if you got something you want to chat about, I can sneak you in. It's not a problem.
Yeah, your recipe for grits.
Yeah, okay. I'll email you that one, all right?
Well, it's just the water and the grits, Pete. Maybe a little salt.
Hey, listen, appreciate so much. Gosh, it was so nice to chat with you.
Man. Well, have a great rest of the program. I know you will, because you got a great agenda.
Have a good time in Prague.
Have a great day.
Yeah, all right. Hey, thanks, Pete.
Bye-bye.
See you later. There was Pete Wernick. I told you, Dr. Banjo, what a remarkable, he's like that all the time. If you get a chance to sit and talk to Pete, he'll be just like that, I promise you. He's informative, he's open, he's educational, he's engaging, and a talented musician. I'm so glad he had a chance to call in, and he's sitting out there in Colorado, and enjoying it as he should. Historian, gosh, go to his website. He did say it was bgjam.com. So many books, so many things that he's written, and he writes them from a level that are just so right on exactly the point. And there you go, Dr. Banjo, Pete Wernick. Pete, thanks so much for calling in.